Hello, and welcome to The Big Web Show. Everything web that matters. I'm Jeffrey Zeldman, and my guest today is Jeffrey McIntyre, a personalizer with poise. Hi, Jeffrey.
Hey, Jeffrey.
That was way too enthusiastic. It is morning, and we both have colds. Is this true?
We do. We soldier on, though.
Yes, it's just like every day. It's just like the fall to winter cold for me.
The tide comes in, the tide goes out. It doesn't matter. It's just the thing you deal with. And particularly, we were saying, you know, if you have small children, it is just part of the texture of your daily life.
But it's giving you a sexy rasp in your voice, which is nice.
Well, I was aiming for gravitas, but I'll take a cheap sex appeal for 100.
You can't aim for gravitas because your voice is too high and friendly. It's like you could do animations. You could do voices for animations. You could do a puppet's voice. You have a really friendly, almost aggressively friendly, but not, you know, but light and playful and musical, and it's nice. And you are a master. So you are right now you're a UX person who specializes especially in customization for as a business opportunity for your clients and how that interfaces with artificial intelligence. So you're doing some pretty interesting stuff. You've got a design consultancy called Predicate, and an initiative of Predicate called Bucket, which means that whichever email address I write to you with is the wrong one, because when you're bucketing, I'm predicating you, and vice versa. But good morning.
Well, good morning, Jeffrey, and thank you for having me. So just to back into that whole "what do you do again" kind of thing,
right?
I mean, the way that I've put it is, I'm a longtime independent strategy and UX consultant who just happens to have focused on the business of content. So, you know, I was around for the early days of the mainstreaming of content strategy as a practice.
Yep.
In UX, and you know, Predicate, which is now 10 years old, is just me. Start small, stay small. And then, you know, my clients have sort of dragged me into personalization and personalized experience through a series of projects. And it's just something that's grown that I needed to give its own little plot of land to sort of seed, if you will.
I think it's some of the most interesting stuff that's happening right now in our field. And I also think it's the positive side of what we have wrought, right? What we internet programmers and designers have wrought. Because the negative side, everybody knows, right? Mm-hmm. We hack elections, make neighbors hate each other, foster the tribal differences between groups, create echo chambers, you know, more than any cable company ever dreamed of. The internet can create these bubbles where everybody believes that everybody thinks like they do because the people in that channel do. We violate people's privacy left and right. I had the pleasure of working with you on a project recently, not nearly finished, but talking to, you know, basically consulting with a company that might or might not go this route. But it was fun to me that the whole industry was in anguish, rending its garments. What have we done? And I was like, boy, I wish our client had done at least a little of that. Our client didn't know when someone bought their product, right?
Well, truthfully, it's happening all over the place now. And personalization is just a sort of feature set that's getting baked into all kinds of marketing automation software, CMSs, and all the big CMS companies have bought or built out personalization suites and functionality. It's in the texture of things like MailChimp and other products that people use to, you know, conduct business in different channels. It's at the basis of everything in conversational user interface is personalized, whether you're talking about bots, voice interactions, or messaging. So personalization is a kind of elusive bag of different technologies and, you know, interaction patterns and techniques. And I think what's been most intriguing to me is just the opportunity is far greater than the challenge. And I feel strongly about that, having done a number of these projects now, where, you know, the good news, and there's not a lot of people out there to sort of share this necessarily other than vendors, is that there's a lot of great software. And it is actually, as we were, you know, experiencing with the client you're referring to, there's a lot of entry level stuff that they can do with even the existing tools or analytics packages they're using to start gathering some of the insights that would form the business case for personalizing or for lightly doing customization around the edges of some of their features and functionality. And so it's actually an area where design needs to be much more involved and UX people need to be much more involved than they are, in my experience, in personalization programs.
And that is engineers are driving it now.
We have marketers, we have engineers, we have product people, and all of them have tremendous amounts to contribute and to provide. And very famously, I think some of the greatest results of personalized experience we see, both from a bottom line perspective and also a brand differentiation perspective, and here I'm thinking about Spotify and algorithmic playlists, mm-hmm. like Release Radar and Discover Weekly, or Netflix. Famously quantified the value of its personalization features. Those do come from product-heavy organizations that really understand how to ship and how to work with a lot of complexity, and certainly they have a lot of extremely gifted talent, and a lot of their resource plentiful. But even in resource-scarce organizations, you can do a lot of this stuff.
That's remarkable. And let's back up just 1 second. And for those listening who may not be mm-hmm. familiar, we're not talking about the kind of – the word customization meant something in the early days of the web. And mm-hmm. so I definitely have listeners who've been doing this a long time, have been working on the web a long time. We're not talking about like Windows 3.1 where you could make black leather jacket your theme. It's not like it's not like going into Chrome and saying, I want a gray background. Oh, I want a picture of my kitten on a background. Right. Like that's not what this is. This is about opportunities to we always talk in UX about getting the right content to the right customer at the right time. Mm-hmm. But you know, in the past, we were limited to saying, let's really figure out our taxonomy and our information architecture so we can do that. Now, basically what we're saying is a person who loves chess and hates checkers should come to the gaming site and see chess games, and a person who loves checkers should see checkers games. Grossly simplified.
But that's exactly the stakes for a designer. Let alone, you know, an engineer, technologist, whomever is, you know, working on these problems, the opportunities and the abilities to do all that are now present. And that's not to say to do them well, because I would say that most of the what I call the personalization fails, and I talk about this a lot when I, you know, give presentations or workshops, are typically failures of design. We see the app uninstall rates come from too many notifications, too much noise. We see correlations where marketing teams realize that they've been oversold a bill of goods and they can't really provide enough of a targeted content rich experience to sort of shore up and get business results that are meaningful. So you really need to get back to design and get back to user-centered principles to be effective. But I'm glad you brought up customization, because people do talk about personalization and customization as somewhat interchangeably, and I think that that's a problem. So yep. Customization is exactly what you were just referring to. It's the system settings in every piece of software you use that allow you to say, nope, don't email me. Yes, I would like to change my avatar. Yes, let's change the palette of this user interface and make it black or whatever, and theme something.
Or make the type bigger.
Of course, yes. Right. So customization, you know, is a kissing cousin to accessibility. It is the user, it has user agency in it. Now, personalization is sort of the obverse of that. It's any experience that uses customer data or understanding to guide, frame, or enhance the interactions they have based on what we know about the context of that person, their behavior, history, and then settings. And the settings is that customization piece. But when we talk about what this actually represents inside digital products, it's page-based experiences and modules that are dynamic. So you know, it's winter and you're shopping on this e-commerce site, you get winter-related promotions. You don't get bathing suit specials. You know, right. Seasonality is sort of baked in to the kind of content that's floated to the surface. There's recommendation engines, which is a whole other software space. There's also channel-specific activities like email campaigns, notifications, whether they're in-app or via different channels. And then, I mentioned conversational UI. So there's a lot... There's a lot of turf that we're talking about when we talk about personalizing an experience, and it's daunting, but it's well worth getting acclimated and understanding just what's possible, because a lot of stuff you can do out of the box now is really exciting, and it really gets us to the heart of what a lot of us got into design for, which is, you know, fighting information overload, providing experiences that are content rich but relevant, and now it's kind of go time to make those decisions. And that's why, you know, a lot of the work that I started that kind of formed the basis for Bucket were taxonomy projects, and I found myself falling backwards into this IA revival tent and realizing, you know, some of the earliest work that was done, you know, even before Peter Morville and Lou Rosenfeld, Marcia Bates out of UCLA around berry picking. All of those old frameworks are extremely relevant now, because we need to figure out how to design for these experiences and what sort of tools we pick for what kind of context. And it's really, really taking us way back to some very basic findings of information retrieval. And it's super exciting.
Tell me more about that.
So berry picking is this concept that Marcia Bates came up with. And she's... really, she walked through this understanding that actually when users access information, they will try various forms of accessing it. They will browse for information. They will look for certain keywords for information. They will sometimes sign up to receive information that they will then later come to them. And now she was working, this is 1989, she was working in a pre-internet modality, but she was thinking about library usage and usage of archives. We are now living in that world where there's push, there's browse, there's, you know, deep consumption, and then there's sort of shallow cursory stuff that we'll just sort of search out. And what I've been working on is a framework called progressive personalization that is an attempt for product teams and design teams to think through more holistically how they're doing personalization, not overwhelm users, find complementary techniques that match, you know, the use case that they're trying to solve for. So you got a job to be done, and really finding the right way to engage a user, not just bully them because you've got notifications and firing them off every 10 minutes, you know, and that's a great way to abuse the user trust and user relationship.
You just said that you've created a framework. Is it something that you do, you know, teach people? Is it a way of thinking that you teach in workshops? Is it a piece of software, or what exactly is it?
It's a very old-fashioned four-quadrant diagram that it sort of derives. It's very derivative and like direct homage to Marcia Bates's work, and then the work, you know, of the early IA godfathers, Morville and Rosenfeld, to allow design teams and product teams and technologists to think about how they're already utilizing personalization in different contexts, and then where there may be gaps in how they're doing that, and thinking about the appropriate tool for the appropriate use. So yeah, I do use it in workshops. It's something I've been evolving directly with my clients. So to sort of pressure test that and refine it. And some of that information you can find on my site, and there'll be more of it by year end. I'm just really excited about it because it gives a handhold for people that want to start personalizing, at different levels of budget or ambition, but are missing that piece or missing that sort of framework to understand or the mental model. Okay, but how do I just sort of wrap my arms around this? There's a lot going on here.
And in terms of lining this up with business goals and business strategy, and in terms of lining it up with user top tasks, what the user actually wants to do, how does this align with those things, or is it the glue that unites those two things?
It has to. None of this works when it's manipulative, when it's dark patterns. And you know, one of the most, to me, exciting things about UXers getting more involved in connected experiences and in personalized UX is these are the people who are holding the banner for empathy. These are the people who are holding the banner for test and learn methodologies. And these are the people that want us, want these products to prosper because they're serving the user. So there's no good served by having all this data and then disregarding what the users want. That's a mug's game. It's a short-term game. And those business results are shallow and they're fleeting. And we see this everywhere.
Even huge organizations are doing it, as we just saw with Facebook, right?
And watch that space. Watch how Facebook, whenever it has a challenge in and around its information sharing or user transparency, all the many challenges they've got, almost universally self-inflicted, they move to customization as a way of addressing the personalization problems. So my bold prediction is, I don't think it's that bold really, based on their track record, is you're going to see them give you more and more levers to pull and knobs to turn to customize the kind of algorithms that are serving you content or determining things.
Which sounds good, but it's making it the user's cognitive problem. And it's they're I know they have 100,000 very talented designers working there, but somehow, maybe that's the problem, too many, but somehow the layers of knobs to twiddle and things are hidden under other layers of knobs and hidden behind panels and folders. And it's like, it's like trying to send a text message with Microsoft Office. It's just, you never know where anything is. It's so complicated. And we know most people don't. It's like we used to say, if the user really needs bigger type, they'll just change their default font settings. And like less than 1% of people actually did that. You know, web designers did that. Web developers did that. And people with particular disabilities who always have to make adjustments to software. So know to look like I can't use anything out of the box because of my impaired vision. So I always have to do X, Y, and Z. Those people were, but most people, they don't want to bother making it their problem. So I guess one of the other issues is that we don't want to bother, but that leaves us trusting corporations to do the right thing by us. And that doesn't always work so well.
Well, certainly. And we can vote with our clicks and our taps. Yeah. And that's why Facebook, Snapchat, now Snap, lots of the big socials are really shedding users, particularly in the developed world where they have an entrenched user base. They're finding it really challenging to walk that line. And you see this with Uber and Lyft. You see it all over the place where there's white hat, black hat kinds of sort of halos that emerge around these organizations based on how they're using data. So trust could not be any more important than it is today. It's dead unsexy. It always will be, probably. But you know, I also want to say that, you know, having been out in the field and some of these conferences where technologists are working on these problems, there's a lot of really great people at some of these very large companies, and they are doing the right thing. They are working on fairness. They're working on serendipity. They're training recommenders to do things that they don't do out of the box or that they should have been doing but aren't doing well. So I see that there's a lot of upside, but I'm not a Pollyanna. And I think, you know, whenever you have a fraught situation, you have two choices. You can get involved at some level and take up a cause, or you can disengage. And I think disengagement is fine at the consumer level. If you have, you know, problems with the politics and the ideologies that are sort of sitting in the background of some of these organizations, and I fully support that. But as a practitioner, I think you have a bigger opportunity, and you have an opportunity to actually wade into this stuff, get your hands a little bit dirty, and realize the art of what's possible just with the tools that are out there already.
Well said, fascinating, and we're going to come right back to it, but I need to do a little commercial break, so here we go. You hang in there, get yourself a water, Jeff, and batten down the hatches, because here we go with commercial announcements. There are job sites that send you tons of the wrong resumes to sort through, and that's not smart. There are job sites that make you wait for the right candidates to apply for your job. That's not smart either. You know what else is not smart? Using your relatives to fill in at work while you look for staff. That's really not smart. But you know what is smart? Going to ZipRecruiter.com/bigwebshow to hire the right person. ZipRecruiter doesn't depend on candidates finding you. It finds them for you. Its powerful matching technology scans thousands of resumes, identifies people with the right skills, education, and experience for your job, and actively invites them to apply so you get qualified candidates fast. That's why ZipRecruiter is rated number one by employers in the U.S. This rating comes from hiring sites on Trustpilot with over 1,000 reviews. And right now, Big Web Show listeners can try ZipRecruiter for free at this exclusive web address, ZipRecruiter.com/BigWebShow. That's ZipRecruiter.com/BigWebShow. That name and again, ZipRecruiter.com/BigWebShow. ZipRecruiter, the smartest way to hire. The Big Web Show today is also brought to you by .tech domains. And this is an interesting product you have to think about for a second. So an outstanding website is one of the most essential parts of your brand, especially if you're from the tech industry, right? If you're in tech and your website sucks, that's a problem. So whether you're launching a cool tech business or looking to establish your personal brand, building your website will be key in your branding efforts. And the first step in building that awesome website is, of course, getting a suitable domain name that is short, memorable, and creative. And at this point, you're probably thinking, yeah, but those are already taken. All the great domain names are taken. Well, that's far from the truth, because now you have the .tech domain extension, which is also, as I mentioned, one of our sponsors for today. With .tech domain extension, you can be sure that your choice of domain name is available, and you have the opportunity to choose a relevant domain name, which will help you in your branding. Some of the names on .tech include www.brilliant.tech, www.shadow.tech, and www.lightly.tech. Don't they sound cool? Well, you can get a website name like that for your startup or personal website too. Tech startups that have raised over $500 million in funding have chosen .tech domains. Even brands like Intel, the Consumer Electronics Show, and Viacom are already using .tech for their tech websites. Yes, the global tech industry is moving toward the new and innovative way of branding their websites by choosing .tech domains. So what are you waiting for? Register your .tech domain now. Visit www.get.tech and use the code TBWS, that's Tom Baker Wilson Stanley, or as you might prefer, The Big Web Show. Code TBWS for The Big Web Show and get 90% off for 1 and 5 year registrations. Don't miss out. 1 year for just $4.99 and 5 years for $24.99. Thank you, .tech domains. Okay, and we'll be back with more sponsors before the end of the show. I know that's often our listeners' favorite part of the show. But right now, we have to go back and talk to this super intelligent, articulate Jeffrey McIntyre of Bucket, an initiative of Predicate, a consulting and research practice dedicated to better digital personalization. Jeff, thanks for your patience as we thanked our sponsors. How do you avoid the creep factor in personalization?
Well, I think, you know, you sort of turn the mirror on yourself and you say, would this be acceptable to me? And there's a lot of interesting research out there that shows the degrees to which people are interested and open to providing data in exchange for certain goods or services or value. However, to sort of whitewash and say, well, we think that they're going to be willing to give us an email address plus a date of birth, you know, just to use a raw example, because they did at this last bank that I worked at, or because so-and-so, ignores the crucial thing, which is context. And that's why this is so hard at a design level, is you've got a sort of multitude of contexts. And, you know, one of my clients referred to it as adding another dimension onto design, because yes, instead of just this sort of page construct, you have how many versions of a page based on every context for every user. And this thing, you know, this gets into the level of sort of 4D chess pretty quickly. But it, again, is why you need a rock solid IA. It's why you need a really crisp understanding of the users that are important to your business, but also the jobs that you are fulfilling for those users.
Right.
So it's really like the thing that I like so much about this is it's a call to focus. And you know, there's nothing worse than when people fail and try and do too much, and they quickly learn that they need to pull back, and that you can really do a lot of brand damage. You can do financial damage. You can do a lot of harm wielding these tools if you're not doing it thoughtfully.
Which is why it's good to have an outside consultant helping. I will give you a plug, but really any outside consultant or any good one is useful, because inside the organization you can have organizational thought, right? Mm-hmm. And outside, because when you make a recommendation, it's not about your livelihood per se, right? I mean, everybody around can go, wow, if this works, we're going to all get raises. And that might be motivation to do something. And the outside consultant can say, doesn't have any skin in that game, but it's just thinking about, can say, you know, let's look at brand reputation for a second. Let's think about, you know, our corporate standards, what we say we stand for, what good we say we do in the world. Let's make sure we're doing that. The biggest creep factor I ever had, I think, was early on in my Facebook experience when I was about to get divorced, but I was separated at the time. And the person I was married to changed her status from in a relationship to it's complicated, or from it's complicated to single. I don't remember what exactly the trigger was. I knew something had happened because all of a sudden I was seeing dating site ads in my sidebar, and not just but like dating site ads for like mature people like me. So it was like, meet mature women. And I was like, why is it doing that? Plus, back then, they used to grab pictures of their own users and let advertisers use those. So I, and I kind of knew everybody. So I would be like, wait a minute, that's a married woman. Why is that? I know. Why is her face appearing under mature singles? They're like, they're doing several kinds of damage there. But the main thing was, as they knew that I had been married. They saw that, that I had a relationship. When my partner decided it was, you know, we both knew what was coming. When she decided, okay, it's time, I'm changing the status, I found out in this indirect way, which was like a punch in the stomach. And that was a deep violation of trust. And basically, I use Facebook, and I like being able to talk to my old friends from high school who have no other real digital footprint, let's say. But man, I never trusted it.
Yeah, I like to say, you know, instead of move fast and break stuff, I say move fast and break your stuff. It seems to have been the corporate motto. And you see the crudity of these tools when they're applied without any sensitivity, empathy, or thought, or and certainly not tested in anything resembling a sort of holistic manner. And today, I think the most common creep factor on personalization tends to be retargeting. So the shoe ad that just follows you around in your browser for a week or two. And, you know, not to just sort of throw away business ideas, but if any in your audience are, you know, promising entrepreneurs working on an analytics startup, I would say one of the most interesting things we could start to quantify is distrust and disengagement based on those kinds of tactics as they're applied. And if we start to see and get some measure of that, it's going to be really interesting to see how fast people peel back from some of those more aggressive techniques. And certainly it's only going to go one way. And that's one of the reasons why I'm so positive about this. We have GDPR. We have a tide moving towards more agency for users in and around their data. And it's going to force organizations, and it's going to compel them to have privacy offices, to have better procedures and better practices in and around, you know, connected experience.
It's funny. I'm an old fashioned web person. So I, like Eric Meyer and I have a company, and we didn't collect email addresses for like 8 years. And our one of our staff members used to tear her hair out. You're a business. Why don't you have? But it was like, well, we don't want to. But it's like they give you the email address when they sign up to attend your conference. They're like, yeah, but that's they did that for the conference. Then we throw it away. Right. We we probably erred too far on the direction of pretend everything's anonymous. But, you know, that's the old school Internet promise. And the new school promise is it's going to be a much more satisfying experience, better for you. You'll get more done faster so you can go out and live life and stop staring at the screen. So from that perspective, it's worth all these things. It's worth as long as you can trust the person, the company, the organization that's doing it. I shared office space a few years ago with a company called Bean. They were a client of some designer friends of mine, and they were fantastic, but they were way too far ahead of their time. Basically, what their premise was, look, right now you're giving away all your data to advertisers, whether you like it or not. That's not right. So we've built this tool which hides all your data, but then you basically get to trade away. You get to say, I'm comfortable with you knowing this. Like, I'm comfortable with you knowing the kinds of butters and jams I buy, but not how I vote or not which political sites I visit. You could set all these things up, and basically you would get deals. So since you're giving the advertiser valuable information that may help them sell a product to you, they give you a discount on that product and so on. It was called Bean. And it was a web product at first. It was fantastic, but they couldn't get sufficient funding to publicize it so people would know. Then they moved it into the Apple Store, which was great, except then Apple decided when Apple came out with content blockers, you know what? No, we've solved this our way. Content blockers, you don't give any of your data away because we value privacy. And it's like, okay, this, but our product was, they were like, no, it doesn't matter. It's done. So that was the end of that product, but they were definitely, like many of our friends who have these wonderful ideas, they were ahead of their time. They knew. And I think what you're describing, what Facebook is clumsily grasping toward, is kind of the same thing of, we're going to let you decide. And I don't know that Facebook's giving you anything in return.
Well, and so there's a very common technique, and Netflix is cycled through doing this, of providing transparency to why a recommendation is provided to
right.
you. You know, this is becoming a very common technique. It's not necessary in all circumstances, but it's great on a hover. You know, it's great on in certain kinds of interactions. It's a nice touch because it's an acknowledgement that your sentient human being who has rights and is guided by certain principles in your digital life as well as your offline life. And you would like to know exactly how this query was formed, this query result was formed, or how this page of, you know, film or television titles was stalked. Right. Give me some understanding.
Because you liked this story with a strong female lead. Here's another show with a strong female lead you might like. That's why we're telling you this.
Yeah, this is all just the new media literacy. And I think this is part and parcel of how we are going to increasingly navigate both, you know, online and offline life. There's a group of Kiwi artists. I cite this art installation project they started called Signs of the Times, in which they took these very evocative New Zealand, you know, tourism ready shots, photographs, and they have billboards blocking the center of the shot saying people who liked this also liked. And it's a great, it's called Signs of the Times. Scott Kelly and Ben Polkingholm. And it's a great statement on what if our offline life was governed by the same principles our online life is. And that's why, again, it seems kind of despairing on the face of it, but this is the new media literacy, is understanding, okay, why am I being served this? And the good side of it is that we can really get to the truth of right content to the right person at the right time. The tools are there to now design those experiences. And certainly I've got a lot of sympathies with, you know, your content performance quotient. These are methodologies for calming down and beating back information overload and trying to serve users at the level of the job that they're trying to accomplish, whatever it may be. And, you know, eliminate the cruft, still give them access to that, but just, you know, reduce the cognitive load,
which I think is a better approach than, again, well-intentioned by Apple, but like, you've used 6% less screen time this week, congratulations, or, you know, that seems kind of silly. Like, that's that's not where the problem occurs. How much time I put in, well, unless it's an addictive compulsive behavior, which it often is, so they are addressing that in a way. But that's like saying, hey, you've had three martinis, to an alcoholic. It's not really going to change their behavior. They're just going to be like, shut up and get me a drink. And I, but the problem, I spent so much time on that website, not because I like spending time on a website, but because it was hard to find the thing I was looking for.
Exactly. Exactly. And that's why we talk about the crudities of a metric and the subtleties of a measure. So the metric is time spent. You don't just say time spent. Oh, great. We got a really sticky experience. That's great. No, it's actually how much time did they spend in the interaction? You know, like, what were they trying to do and failing to achieve? And if you don't test and understand that fuller context, right, you're really insulting the user, and you're abusing the user, and you're going to lose.
This gets us back to Jerry McGovern's top tasks methodology, which is like, what did the customer come there to do? And were they able to do it? Were they able to accomplish it? How many clicks did it take? How, you know, with the assumption that they have actually better things to do than read your website.
Yep. And when I work with clients, jobs to be done is another one of these ascendant frameworks that people use, just down at that user task level, that you can prove out intention and failure success across a couple of interactions. That becomes the basis for understanding whether personalized experience is going to work in your environment.
This is great. I have to take another quick commercial break. Want to thank Linode, who are a sponsor of this show. Instantly deploy and manage an SSD server in the Linode cloud. Get a server running in seconds with your choice of Linux distro, resources, and node location. What I really love about this sponsor is how hard it is to read their copy, because it's great stuff, but it's hard on in audio, I think, right? Unless you're very familiar with the technology, but let's go ahead and try. So you get a $20 credit equivalent to 4 months. You get access to 10 data centers worldwide. Plans for Linode start at 1 gigabyte of RAM for $5 a month. High memory plans start at 16 gigabytes. There's a 7-day money back guarantee, and you can get a server running in under a minute. But wait, there's more. There's hourly billing with a monthly cap on all plans and add-on services, backups, node balancers, Longview. There's 24/7 friendly support with phone support available. There's VMs for full control running Docker containers, encrypted disk, VPNs, etc. This is where it starts getting like ethereal, I think. But I'm not critiquing. I'm critiquing with love. Native SSD storage, 40 gigabyte network, Intel E5 processors. Block storage is available in Newark, Fremont, Dallas, Atlanta, Frankfurt, London, and Singapore, and soon coming to Tokyo. There's a beta manager. They're now taking comments on the beta manager. Go to cloud.linode.com. There's open source single page app build using a cutting edge React.js stack and backed entirely by the public beta API at github.com/linode/manager. And there's an API version 4, a RESTful API, which is now out of beta. So I could give you more URLs and more technical sounding jargon, but I think the best thing for you to do is go to linode.com/bigweb and get a $20 credit when you use promo code BIGWEB2018. That's linode.com/bigweb and get a $20 credit when you use promo code BIGWEB2018. We are now speaking with Jeffrey McIntyre of Bucket. This is Bucket.com. Jeffrey, I know that we're going to have links in the show notes to some of the fascinating things we've been talking about. The predecessor to Lou, the Margaret, you said? This is like something...
Marcia Bates, and she's Marcia well Bates. Known to the IA Summit community, and, okay. and some hardcore IA folks will recognize her name. And I believe it's Marcia, not Marcia. But she's amazing, and she's still attending some of these IA summits. She shows up in places, and she's really amazing. I have a lot of appreciation for her.
It is my shame that I only learned about her on this show after 25 years in this industry. I mean, to me, everything started with Lou and Peter in that area. Of course, IA wasn't my specialty, so that's my slight excuse for my woeful ignorance, which is sounding still rather problematic. Why is she well known? Why isn't she as well known to the general UX community?
Well, can I venture a guess and say gender? I learned about her by talking to Jenny Benevento, who's at Etsy and is an August taxonomy and IA talent. And she told me about berry picking. And I said, berry picking? I've kind of heard about this, but I don't know what it, you know, and I don't know its provenance. And then I, you know, cycled back and talked to Lou at another time. And he said, oh, yeah. She was like front and center in our thinking when we were writing the Polar Bear book. So I think it's, you know, I'm going to call out gender on this. She's unsung or undersung and should be better known.
Fair enough. We have only a few minutes left. I could talk to you for hours and frequently have, but we have only a few minutes left because of hard stops in busy schedules. So I will ask you, if you had one takeaway for the listener right now, what should they walk away thinking about? What can they be, where can they go to start their own journey on personalization with purpose and poise?
Well, I think that there's increasingly better stuff out there you can read online. I certainly am going to flog my wares. And if you go visit thisisbucket.com, there's links to some of the things that I've written about. But don't take my word for it. There is a consortium of personalization professionals, which formed last year. I'm a founding member of. There's some great practitioners that are coming out, people that have been working at the edges of this practice as a content subject matter expert or as a agency owner who's been selling software and implementing it really successfully. There's lots of people that are starting to come together, and you know, I'm going to continue to work on enablement and making this stuff more accessible to more people and spreading that word. I've got a product in the works with Colin Egan. There's more to come. I would just say watch this space, but certainly there's some good people out there to follow on Twitter and elsewhere, and it's a place where I think UXers really, really deserve it to themselves to get more involved, because there's a lot of opportunity.
And if you go to at Jeff McIntyre on Twitter, it's McIntyre, M-A-C, not McIntyre. Is one Scots and the other is Irish, or
I am a mutt, and I the surname is more pure Scot, but I've got Welsh and Irish in my lineage.
But McIntyre, Mac, M-A-C is Scot, is Scottish,
yeah,
spelling.
It means son of entire.
Son of entire.
Yes. Yes. All Macs, that's what a Mac means, son of.
You're the Mac.
Isn't it amazing the things you learn on a podcast?
This is truly great. But if you're interested in links to other articles on the same subject, if you follow Jeff McIntyre on Twitter, he's going to be linking to a lot of that stuff. I follow him. You should follow him if you're interested in Bucket Holdings in the lovely Hudson Valley. He could probably arrange a tour. In fact, he's... I hope to get out there soon with my kid and visit the Dia Arts Center and the Earthworks and all this wonderful stuff where you live, and just see what it's like to breathe fresh country air again. Have a wonderful day, Jeffrey, and thank you for joining us today. Thank you, Big Web Show listeners, and we'll be back with another Big Web Show very, very soon.
Thanks for having me.